In the dark of the midnight have I oft hid my face, while the storm howls above me and there's no hiding place. Mid the crash of the thunder, precious Lord, hear my cry. Keep me safe till the storm passes by. And my topic this evening is In the Eye of the Storm. It was summer on the South China Sea, and the warship that I was on had just left a combat zone in Southeast Asia, and we'd pulled in for repairs into a port in Taiwan. Much needed repairs, I should add, because the shipyard workers came aboard and they said, well, you got a lot of problems here. For starters, the number two boiler has had it. Kill the fire in that thing. We got a lot of work to do. And so began what promised to be a much-needed rest for the crew. We had been in combat. We had been pretty heavily engaged, and we just needed some time to kind of decompress and think about where we'd been and where we'd like to go and just think about home. And so began what turned out to be a couple, 3 weeks in southern Taiwan. We got to enjoying that. You know, just from the shipyard, it was just a short walk into the intriguing town of Kaohsiung. And to get there, you had to cross the railroad tracks, where old-fashioned steam locomotives still moved freight cars around the yards. And the air was rich with the smell of steam and hot iron and lubricating oil. And we were beginning to really enjoy those summer days when all of a sudden over at the headquarters building, the signal tower ran a flag hoist. There were two red flags with black squares in the middle. One of them just means a storm's coming, but two of them means a typhoon. We call them hurricanes. The Brits call them tropical cyclones, I think. By whatever name you want to call them, they're the same ugly beast. They're this swirling mass of air that sucks the guts out of anything it passes over. This one was headed right down our throats, right into the Straits of Formosa. And from Commander 7th Fleet came orders, all vessels, clear ports, clear all ports, get out to sea. See, in a typhoon, you don't want to be in a harbor, because your anchor can drag, and always behind you, there's the nightmare of that lee shore, and you grind your ship up on that thing, and you've ended your career right there. So, with the boiler out, we steamed up as best we could and limped out through the jetty channel, just north of that hill that runs south of town, and we put out into the South China Sea to meet an enemy far bigger than anything we'd seen in combat. Let me tell you a little bit about typhoons. Point number one is they're not habit-forming. They're the original e-ticket ride. You've got green water coming over the bow like a horizontal Niagara, and out there the boiling ocean with waves so large that even from the bridge of a warship, you're looking up at them. And when you crest one of those monsters and you drop into the trough on the other side, hang on to your dentures, because it's going to hurt. I've been through two of those rascals. I encountered one over there in the Straits of Formosa. The second one was off the west coast of Mexico and the Gulf of Tehuantepec. Believe me, I didn't lose anything in either of those storms I want to go back looking for. They're not habit-forming. Point number two. You encounter a typhoon at sea, you may experience a deceptive time in which you think the storm is over. The wind doesn't exactly die, it abates, and the ocean doesn't go glassy calm. It's still lumpy. You know there's trouble around you. But it's better than it was. And if you look upward, you just may see through patches of open sky a little bit of sunlight. But you do that and it's all an illusion. Because if you see the sun, you're looking up through the funnel. You're in the eye of the storm. Which means that peace, the peace you enjoy momentarily, is going to be pretty short-lived. means there's another storm ahead of you. And if in the northern hemisphere you have the bad luck to be steaming from south to north, what that means is that you're going to be steaming into what we call a dangerous semicircle. That's the one where the rotation of the storm also matches the direction it's traveling, so the two winds compound each other and then the sea really gets ugly. Ugliest side of a hurricane, the storm behind you, the storm you left, isn't a patch to what you're going to face on the other side. That's the kind of day when even veteran sailors with gold hash marks all the way up their sleeve turn a little green and learn how to pray. So if you sail from one storm to another, it means you're crossing the eye of the storm, but watch out. Because the new storm you encounter will come from the opposite direction of the one you got out of. The wind's going to shift. If the wind in the first storm came from the west, this next one's coming from the east. And it'll present you with challenges you hadn't expected. In other words, when you're in the eye of the storm, you haven't escaped anything. And the moment of peace you enjoy is only a prelude. Now let's open the Word. I invite you to join me in the book of Daniel. Book of Daniel, chapter 12. And let's get reconnected with reality. There's a lot of unreality around us. Not everything everybody says has any connection with reality. And you watch very much of what Hollywood produces and you'll really get divorced from reality. You went back to the real world, go inside this book. Daniel chapter 12, verse 1, "And at that time shall Michael stand up, the great prince which standeth for the children of thy people. And there shall be a time of trouble, such as never was since there was a nation." That, my friends, is the dangerous semicircle. Now, let's take a look at it in the words of Jesus. Let's go over to the New Testament here, the book of Luke. Luke chapter 21. Jesus is just answering his disciples' question. Here's a bunch of young Jewish guys. They have put it together. They figured out that something's going to come along called the end of the world. And they kind of want to know what to be looking for. And they ask the Lord, what will be the signs? And Luke 21's his answer. And it's pretty graphic. And he goes through, like a laundry list, all the things you look for in this world. And then finally he sums it up. And let's get down here to verse 25. "And there shall be signs in the sun, moon, and stars, and on the earth distress of nations with perplexity, the sea and the waves roaring, and men's hearts failing them for fear." The New International Version says men will faint with terror. It uses the T word. "Men's hearts failing them for fear, and for looking after those things which are coming on the earth, for the powers of heaven shall be shaken." That's Jesus' version of it. You go to Revelation, you see this thing fleshed out with a description of specific things that will happen near the end of time. An economic embargo, a buy-sell decree, a death decree, a whole array of issues unique to the end of time. Now, I don't mean to dwell unnecessarily or gratuitously on trouble, end time trouble. There's no point in doing it unnecessarily. But it does make sense to me that if Daniel takes the trouble to discuss this, and Jesus does, and it's reported in Matthew and Mark and Luke, and John the Revelator does it in Revelation, it just might be a good idea to do a little thinking about it, right? What does the dangerous semicircle look like? Well, the Bible has just given us a predictive prophecy about it. With that in mind, let's talk a little bit about the world in which we live, just for a few moments as this Sabbath afternoon wanes. And then let's see if anything we see in our present world is like the description penned in these prophetic passages. On September 11, 2001, we felt the shock of a frontal passage. It's like a storm coming through. It's the front, first front. of a storm, and it hits suddenly and it hits violently. And it ripped through our lives, and it ripped through our hearts, and it ripped through our wonderful country, and it left us sad. But in retrospect, what happened on September 11 was not the first hint that a storm was coming. For the past 10 or 12 years, we had sensed a rising wind. We'd felt a rising wind of some strange new pattern in world events. In the heart of Africa, hundreds of beautiful, innocent people died for nothing except the coordinated attack of religious fanatics who wanted to make a point in human blood. Who, I also might add, were and still do wanting to establish a world religion. Thank you, I appreciate that. I have discovered something lately, that something that I am saying makes the devil less than happy with me. I went to Norway to give a series of lectures there, and I was going to go down to Denmark. I gave one. I gave one on Omega and current events within the church. I thought it came across the way I wanted it to. I thought the Lord blessed. That night I got as sick as can be. I was just dizzy as a loon. I couldn't even sit up. I had to be evacuated out of Norway. I had to cancel the rest of the series. We flew home. I got well. Then my wife came down sick. I'd gone down to Southern California and tried to give the same talk. She got sick. I was scheduled to go to Australia to do the same thing. Her illness prevented me going there. We had to cancel a trip. I went down to Southern Cal and fortunately finally got the talk on American Cassette Ministries tapes. And right after that, my son came down sick and all other kinds of misfortunes happened. So if the devil tries to shut me off this afternoon, you'll understand why. And give credit to the source where credit is due. And I thank you for that water. Now we'll try to go on. In the Khobar Towers, same thing happened. Religious fanatics killed hundreds more innocent people. In the World Trade Center in the early 1990s, terrorists still early in their learning curve, naively supposed that they could maybe topple one of the twin towers, and if it fell over into the other one, they would both come tumbling down. It was very, very immature planning. What they did was drive their explosive truck down under one corner of the parking structure, hoping to uproot the building and toss it over against Trade Tower number 2. That was before they woke up to the fact that at the price of 19 airline tickets and willingness to give their lives, they could buy an Air Force. For several years, we have felt the stirring of ominous storm winds. It came from Yemen when suicide bombers attacked the USS Cole, and on September 11, 2001, we felt the wind turn furious when terrorists finally got it together in a big way. And then we knew on a September morning that had begun so innocently, so blue, so clear, we knew then the hurricane had arrived. My first thought on that occasion was, finally, something's happened that will cause God's people to wake up. I mean, it was inconceivable to me that anyone could sleep through anything like 9/11. How could we? I mean, even non-believers sensed something was coming, and they gathered by the thousands in public to pray. They filled Yankee Stadium. They wound around the block to go to church the next Sunday. And in Boston, they knelt by the thousands publicly to pray. How could we sleep through it? If they could wake up, couldn't we? I even wrote a book about it. I just dropped everything, and I wrote a book, and it came out that fall called Morning's Trumpet, in which I tried to review what was happening in our world and what it meant to be an Adventist on the brink of the Advent. By the way, that one has sold out. They're not available, so I'm not able to provide any more. The only place that I know a few might still be available is at the ABC out in Central California. I think they still have some. We reprinted about 3 or 4 editions of that thing, and it seemed to me that the interest in the topic was just cooling off, and I saw no reason to print any more of them. And so after 9/11, I was thinking to myself, how could anybody sleep through this? But brothers and sisters, I think we're trying. as I travel and speak, I think that 9/11 was a wake-up call, and I wonder if we heard it. Now look at the fulfilling prophecy and its aftermath. Let's go to Revelation now. Look at Revelation 13, very familiar text that we know, they're written in our minds. We hardly need to turn the page to look them up, but let's do it to be sure I've got it right here. Revelation 13, verse 11. And I beheld another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb, and immediately thereafter, what does the next phrase say? He spake like a dragon. In cosmic time, in the kind of time that heaven looks at, it's like that, it's only moments, and the lamb-like beast becomes a dragon. By the way, out in California where I come from, people are starting to say, well, you know, it's been 150 years and more, and the Lord hadn't come yet. Maybe we just ought to relax on this imminent Advent thing. Now, with all due respect to my friend Cliff, it makes me turn red to hear that kind of talk. Brothers and sisters, if we don't have a sense of an imminent Advent, what are we doing here? And people say, well, it's been a century and a half. You know what a century and a half is? Imagine that the whole timeline of recorded history, the 6,000-year history that our Bible talks about since the time of Adam, suppose that was laid out like a timeline, one nautical mile long. A nautical mile, 6,000 feet. It's a little longer than a statute mile. So that works out good for 6,000 years, doesn't it? 1 foot equals a year. Got me? If the whole history of the world could be described on a timeline 6,000 feet long, from us back to 1844 is only like about 161 feet. That's as near as your neighbor's doorstep, ain't it? So don't get discouraged. The Lord hasn't waited that long. And by the way, what's He waiting for? There have been several times in human history when everything necessary for the end of time to occur rapidly was all set up. It's like that now. I have said it before, I'll say it again. In terms of being ready for the Advent, human history is far readier than is God's church. Human history is ready to turn this thing loose and let it go. So Revelation 13:11 talks about this new nation with lamb-like horns, and just a few instants later in prophetic time, it's suddenly speaking like a dragon. Now notice something. Look at what happened in the aftermath of 9/11. Like a slumbering dragon, America awakened with a vengeance. And what's the very first thing we did? We conquered Afghanistan. Now that may not seem like much, but it's been tried before and it's never been done. The Brits tried it, and they got their lunch eaten in the Khyber Pass. The Russians tried it, and they got their lunch eaten, and their empire came apart, and there ain't any Soviet Union anymore. It's gone. One writer said, nobody wins in Afghanistan, not even the Afghans. But we did. We did, and we changed the regime to one friendly to the United States in the aftermath of 9/11. In the aftermath, like a slumbering dragon, America awakened to a strange new doctrine called preemptive war. And we invaded Iraq in what was a very high risk, but very daring move. Now, let me talk a little bit about the Iraqi invasion. I'm an ex-newscaster. I used to gather information for the Navy on the Soviet fleet. So drawing from my background, just let me assure you that when you hear the news at night or watch the news, you don't always get the news. Okay? Just get that clear. Now let me give you a little insight. I'm not going to say much about this. Let me give you just a little insight into what is happening in Iraq. This thing was a strategic chess play designed to change the whole geopolitical balance of this world. That's what it was. It was designed to change the whole balance of power in Europe and the Middle East. The focus of American power would move out of Europe, especially old Europe. You ever heard that term? which means the old classic Western European nations. It would move out of Western Europe. It would relocate in the Middle East. American power would be projected right smack dab into the Islamic world. We would perform a brilliant military maneuver. We would shatter the Islamic monolith by going right between two of our major enemies. It's a classic military maneuver. Iran would be on one side, Syria would be on the other, they would be split. We would have split their forces. And joining us would be the nations of New Europe, that is the ex-Soviet satellites. Guess who sent their troops? And guess why old Europe didn't like to get into this very much? Because the whole strategic balance of the world would shift. In terms of planning, Condi Rice is no fool. She's a very brilliant lady. It's a brilliant plan, and she and the others put it together. The only problem was it relied on the cooperation of the Iraqis. And it isn't happening like it was supposed to, is it? Now, where do we find ourselves today in a post-9/11 world? We find ourselves, strangely enough, in a brief moment where the wind has slackened. It's still gusting. It's not calm seas, but it has settled down some. The wind has slackened. Through broken clouds, you occasionally can see some sunlight. For example, our Iraqi invasion, as risky and troublesome as it was, at least has pushed the fight offshore. It's drawn every terrorist on planet Earth, I think, right there to Iraq, because they know that's live or die, that's win or lose. They win or lose there. If they can beat us there, they won the war. So it's pushed the terrorism problem temporarily far from our shores, and meanwhile, we have the luxury of sitting home temporarily and watching terrorism on our big screen TVs. And if we're really into enjoying this world, we watch it on our big screen TVs while we sit in the jacuzzi. Meanwhile, the economy started to rebound. We're flirting with 11,000 in the Dow right now. And more Americans go home at night to their own house than we've ever had in human history. So in terms of rebounding from this thing, despite the worst that terror could do to us, including a $4 trillion loss in our stock market, we've come back. This remarkable country has come back. There are clouds, to be sure. But in America, we're enjoying a little time of misleading sunlight. But be careful, because the sun you see is coming through the funnel. We are in the eye of the storm. Now let's go back to the Word of God. Let's go back to Daniel 12. We were there a few moments ago. Let's go back and reread the thing. Daniel 12, verse 1, "At that time shall Michael stand up, the great prince which standeth for the children of thy people, and there shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation." What's Daniel saying? He says, this thing is worse than anything that has ever happened or ever will happen to that time. In other words, it's worse than the fall of Rome when those barbarian hordes out of the steppes of Asia came galloping in and left Europe in darkness for 1,000 years. Worse than that. And 1 Thessalonians suggests it'll happen to people who thought they were safe. Let's turn over here, if you will, to 1 Thessalonians 5, verse 3. 1 Thessalonians 5, verse 3, what does it say? "For when they shall say peace and safety, then what happens? Sudden destruction." And I guess there's no way out of this thing, because look how the verse ends, "and they shall not escape." Now let's get real. Look out there into the future. Look across the eye of the storm at the other wall. It's a storm wall. It's roiling with dark clouds. It's riven with lightning. What we're looking at is the dangerous semicircle. Now, what's going to happen? Ladies and gentlemen, let me say it as plainly as I know how. I have never seen anything more brutally clear than this. I think Lucifer
is going to hit us with everything he's got. But remember, when you cross the eye of the storm reverses. The wind comes from a different direction. You can be blinded by surprise. And what's the analogy here? This time, it won't be just acts of terrorism and physical risk in this country. This time, the fury of the storm will shift to focus on the Constitution. And it'll all seem so logical and necessary. What will happen to the Constitution will seem so logical and necessary that if you aren't seriously in the Word of God, you'll welcome it. Now let me explain what I mean. To ward off terrorist threats to America, what do we most need? What is it we have to do? We have to know who the bad guys are, and we need to know where they're going. Who's on the street? Who should be there? Who shouldn't be there? We also need to know about money. Follow money. Find out where it comes from, where it goes, what it's buying. Follow the money, and you can figure out anything. Now, how are you going to do that? Reference was made a few moments ago by a prior speaker to the issue of national identity cards. Well, I'm sorry. This is my prepared talk, and this is what I'm going to say. How do you account for people and follow the money? And the answer is this thing. What I got in my hand is a prototype that could easily become a national identity card. It's got the magnetic stripe on the back. It has the silver laser stripe on the front. That's a segment out of a CD-ROM. And on it, it has a little gold transistor. This was given to me several years ago by a man in the Middle West whose company makes these things. The transistor here is crude by comparison. Today, we can put a billion transistors in that particular chip. This thing could hold everything you ever did. I'm talking your health records, your x-rays, your medical records, your lab reports, your hospitalizations, doctor visits, insurance policy, insurance claims, your driving record, your driver's license, your immigration status, if you're a new American, and if you've ever had an adventure with the law, that could be there too. Not to mention all of your federal income tax returns. Now do you like it so good? Could easily become you. All you need is one of those things. And just suppose for a moment that everybody in America, citizen and visitor alike, was required to carry a national identity card. This is not academic. This is not unnecessary to talk about. This is going to happen. You can see it coming like a freight train. Suppose everybody carried one of these things, biometrically engineered, so that only you could use it. It's safe. You know, if the retinal scan doesn't match up with what this thing recognizes, it just doesn't work. And suppose you were required to present on request to any law enforcement officer your national identity card, which could quickly be scanned. You could be identified, and any outstanding warrants could then be executed, and your shopping trip would be interrupted by a trip downtown. Supposing it was necessary to carry one of these things to get a job, what would the result be? You know what the result would be? Almost instantaneous solutions to a whole bunch of problems like illegal immigration, drug money, terrorists on the loose, even purse snatching. Because why snatch this when your eye retina doesn't match what the card has in it? No point in stealing a lady's purse. It doesn't have anything you can spend. Add to that medical records, and now if you're traveling out of town and you're in an auto accident, suddenly the doctor instantly knows all of your allergies, all of your problems, all your past history, and you can get cared for easier. There are a lot of reasons to adopt some way of identifying citizens and having them carry with them all the information necessary to conduct their lives. Now, carry that logic a little further. Let's make the card the only medium of financial exchange. In other words, you don't need this anymore because you got this. Okay? In fact, all you've got is this, and that's all you need. You take money out of circulation, you digitize it.
You force everybody over a period of, say, 90 days to bring all of their cash in. They can rip the mattress open, pull that out, put it in the bank. It gets digitized. The only thing is you got to tell how you came by that money. There's where the IRS cleans up. And if you don't bring it in, you can just start a fire with it in the stove because it ain't going to be worth anything. See? Make it the medium of financial exchange, and suddenly you've solved the problem of the U.S. currency being used as the medium of exchange by rascals all over the world. I'm talking drug lords and terrorists. The U.S. $100 bill is the world medium of exchange for unsavory people. Make them use this, and all of a sudden, those vaults full of U.S. dollars are worthless, and you've got a handle on crime. What I'm getting at is there are going to be a lot of very powerful arguments to adopt something like this. A lot of reasoning behind it. A lot of positive effects could flow. You see, Lucifer's end time challenges to us are going to be hideously dangerous. What'll come along will seem perfectly logical. You'll never see the trap unless you've read this book. Now, are we ready for it? At this point, no, we're not ready for this. Even the unbeliever who never read Revelation 13 isn't ready for this. They would resist it as an intrusion into privacy. But let me tell you something, one or two more 9/11s, and you're going to be carrying this thing. Or something more sophisticated. It's not inconceivable that maybe they'd try to put some tracking device in it. I don't know. Those are purely conjecture. But the point I'm getting at is the technology to accomplish Revelation 13 is not something we have to wonder about. It's here. You're carrying stuff, crude versions of it in your wallet. Let me make something perfectly clear, though. There is nothing inherently immoral with this. This technology is not inherently bad. If it were, none of us would be carrying credit cards, would we? There's nothing immoral even in a national identity card. Inherently, no, there's nothing wrong with it. It may be inconvenient. It may seem like an intrusion into privacy. There is nothing immoral with this until what? Until you have to violate your conscience to get this thing. Then it becomes immoral. There's the point where it becomes a problem. But you do this, and you've constructed the perfect mechanism for the fulfillment of one of the Bible's most sobering prophecies. Let's go back to it. Revelation 13, 16. And he causeth all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and bond, to receive a mark, and that no man might buy or sell, save he that had the name, the mark, or the number. And along with that is Revelation 13, 15, saying that if the economic embargo at the end of time does not bring the nonconformist around, we will authorize the use of lethal force, a death decree. A death decree coupled in the same text with the word worship, which means that Earth's terminal crisis will be a religious one. And my friends, it will not be Islam versus Christianity. Nothing in Revelation suggests to me that Islam will be a major factor at the end of time. Why? Because Jesus said the gospel will go to the whole world, including the Islamic world. Something's going to happen. I'm not smart enough to figure out what, but I'm telling you this, Christianity will indeed prevail in this fight. Problem is, it will be a shallow, superficial Christianity that has lost the precious lesson of human freedom. Is it possible that liberty could disappear? Let me quickly reprise what we covered in my seminar today in just a couple of minutes. Over and over in American history, we have thrown liberty away for the sake of protecting the country and ensuring its survival. Abe Lincoln suspended habeas corpus in the Civil War. One writer said that up to that time, the period of the Civil War was the low point for American civil liberties. Thousands of people were literally incarcerated and held for long periods of time with the loss of civil rights. Necessary? I guess so. It held a union together. But in a time of stress, a nation suspends liberty. Same thing happened in 1942. General DeWitt, head of the Western Defense Command, said in a statement very politically incorrect and very insensitive to some wonderful people, and I'm just going to give you his words so you get a feeling for the mood of that man and the time. He said, "A Jap's a Jap. There's no way to determine loyalty. Lock them all up." And they were. Executive Order 9066. In the same year, habeas corpus was suspended in Hawaii for the duration of the year, and when a federal judge complained, the commanding general threatened to court-martial him. Cold War, Emergency Detention Act of 1950 empowered the Attorney General to arrest and detain anybody for whom he had reasonable grounds to believe they would engage in espionage or sabotage. And now let me close with a concern I expressed in my seminars, but I want to say it again, because it goes to a very fragile First Amendment. In the recent case of Elk Grove School District versus Newdow, Justice Clarence Thomas, with brilliant legal argument, has suggested that the First Amendment's Establishment Clause does not protect the individual. Absolutely unique. You see, in order for the First Amendment, for any amendment of the Constitution to protect an individual against state action infringing on his rights, it has to be incorporated in the 14th Amendment, the incorporation concept. So Justice Thomas has taken the position that the Free Exercise Clause does flow directly from the Constitution to the individual. I've drawn that here. The other half of the First Amendment Religion Clause is the Establishment Clause. Congress shall pass no law respecting an establishment of religion. And Justice Thomas says that one is not designed to protect the individual. It protects the states from the federal government and allows the states to establish a religion without any danger of federal interference. Brilliant end run around all the wall of separation issues that we lawyers have been seeing. Justice Thomas's thing, if carried to its logical conclusion, would allow, I presume, the establishment of the state religion for the state of Utah or the state of Mississippi. The state of California, I guess, would be New Age. But do you see where we're going with this thing? First Amendment rights are already fragile. Add to that the catalyst of a dangerous enemy like militant Islam, and the future of religious liberty is very much in doubt. Now, what I just cited you here from Clarence Thomas is not Abe Lincoln or World War II or 1950. That is 2004, just as recent as last year. Ladies and gentlemen, we are in the eye of the storm. But now the good news. There's somebody bigger than the storm, isn't there? Okay. In the worst that Lucifer can do, there's still a king on the throne. See, not only does Daniel 12 describe a time of trouble, it also promises a rescue. Now, as Paul Harvey would used to say, let's go back, read Daniel 12, and get the rest of the story. Daniel 12, verse 1. "And at that time shall Michael stand up, the great prince, which standeth for the children of thy people, and there shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation." But look how the verse ends. "And at that time, in the eye, beyond the eye, in the storm wall, in the dangerous semicircle of the storm, at that time thy people shall be delivered. Every one that shall be found written in the book." That's why we're here today, isn't it? We want to be written in the book. That's the only place to be, the only book that matters. See, Daniel 12, verse 1 is not just a verse about threat. It's not a verse about threat so much as it is a verse about deliverance. Jesus said in Luke 21, when you sense all this stuff beginning, that's the time to look up. This evening, do you sense it beginning? You feel it happening around you. In the eye of the storm, it might be a good time to look up, because what you will see is not broken sunlight, but a coming king. Till the storm passes over, till the thunder sounds no more.
till the clouds roll forever from the sky. Hold us fast. Let us stand in the hollow of thy hand. Keep us safe till the storm passes by. Let's pray. Dear Lord, we thank you for wonderful people concerned about liberty. We recognize that if liberty weren't important to you, Calvary wouldn't have been necessary. We just pray we will serve it well. We have concerns about where our country is going, but we love our country. Help us to support it in every way we can and defend liberty as long as it can be defended. And when the time comes it can't be anymore, help us to endure the collapse of liberty with regal grace, knowing you're still on the throne. In Jesus' name.
You have been listening to another special American Cassette Ministries presentation. This is a digital recording for optimum sound quality. International copyright 2005, all rights reserved. To order additional CDs or audio cassettes of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, call our toll-free order line, 1-800-233-4450. For international calls, dial 717-652-7000. You may also download our latest catalog or order from our secure website at www.americancassette.org. If American Cassette Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now to send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with the speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your letters and ongoing financial support are greatly appreciated. This year, 2005, we are celebrating our 30th anniversary, 30 years of faithfully maintaining the integrity of the Three Angels' messages. American Cassette Ministries is not a one-man band. It is an orchestra. The speakers associated with this ministry are all on the same page. There is no theological compromise here at ACM. We're helping prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.